Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. We're very, very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. And you can visit the website at www.askelm, that's ASKELM.com. You can email David Seeloff at this address, David@askelm.com. And we are beginning today part four of the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And this is a multi-part series, and it is a beautiful story. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. Get you back in harness here, like a sled dog.
Yeah, I'm having problems with my voice.
Well, we'll take the reins and run with it.
Okay.
What we're doing is the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. That's the actual title, The Star That Astonished the World. And we're in chapter four, beginning chapter four, which is titled The Real Star of Bethlehem. And this is written by Dr. Ernest L. Martin. The latest copyright and the latest edition was 1996. So I'm going to read the online internet version, which is available on the ASK website. So, getting into chapter four, The Real Star of Bethlehem. While reading Dr. Martin's words, while the spectacular astronomical signs in the 18 months from May 3 BC to December 2 BC would have caused wonderful interpretations by astrologers on behalf of Augustus and the Roman Empire, the Magi decided to go to Jerusalem with gifts to a newborn Jewish king. The Magi focused on Judea and not Rome at this crucial time in history. So let's look at some of the astrological and biblical factors that may have brought the Magi to Jerusalem and then to Bethlehem. Since the New Testament says that the Magi saw the, quote, star, end quote, rising in the east, it would most naturally be called a morning star. The book of Revelation has Jesus saying of himself, quote, I am the root and offspring of David, the bright and morning star. This is in Revelation 22, verse 16. The Apostle Peter also mentioned that Jesus was symbolically associated with, quote, the day star, end quote. This is in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 19. The above verses refer to celestial bodies that were well known and recognized in the first century, and they inspired symbolic messianic interpretation by early Christians of later times. There were several prophecies in Isaiah, which generally were interpreted as referring to the Messiah. One has definite astronomical overtones to it. Isaiah said, quote, the Gentiles have come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. And this is in Isaiah 60, verse 3. This prophecy could easily refer to the rising of some star. It would be particularly appropriate to a morning or a day star. Now, the gospel writer Luke, in his gospel, referring to the celestial symbolism of Isaiah 60, verse 3, which spoke of God being at, quote, the daybreak, in other words, the rising, the daybreak from on high that has visited us to give light to them that sit in darkness. And this is in Luke chapter 1, verses 78 to 79. Now we're going to look at astronomy and the New Testament. These references reveal that celestial bodies were symbolically important to the New Testament writers. We know that the generality of the world was then engrossed with such symbolic concepts. the rising of a star or a planet just before sunrise was particularly significant in interpreting events related to important people. And Luke, in his gospel, refers to Jesus as a star which will bring great light to all the world. Now, I want to do an aside here, is that astronomical events that have significance to a person only refer to God, or Christ, rather, only refer to events of regarding Christ, the Savior, and to a lesser extent to Israel. They do not refer to other individuals at all. Period. That's why astrology doesn't work. It does refer, the signs in the sky do refer to Christ and the plan of salvation. But they have nothing to do with other individuals, kings, or you, or me, or the people listening to this individually, or even as a group. But they only refer to Christ. Now, back to the text. Christ and the plan of salvation. Now, back to the text. With this in mind, let us recall that from our first chapter, that on the morning of August 12th, 3 BC, about an hour and 20 minutes before sunrise, Jupiter rose as a morning star in conjunction with the planet Venus. How would astrologers or magi have interpreted this union? Well, let's look at some of the generally accepted beliefs of astrologers who lived in the time of Augustus and King Herod. Jupiter was known astrologically as the father of the gods. The planet Jupiter symbolized this deity. And in early August of the year 2 BC, Jupiter had just left its vicinity near the sun and was conjoined with Venus, the planet Venus. This could have been an indication of a coming birth. Quote, Jupiter often was associated with the birth of kings and therefore was called the king planet. This is in Hendrickson's book, The Gospel of Matthew. And once again, all the full listing of footnotes and bibliography are in the printed version and in the introduction of this book online. Now, here was the king planet in conjunction with Venus. To the Chaldeans and the Magi, Venus was Ishtar, the mother, the goddess of fertility. Thus, Jupiter, the father, was now in conjunction with Venus, the mother. Now, could this have signified to astrologers that the birth of a new king was imminent? This conjunction could have been a favorable sign because these two planets were known by astrologers as the greater and the lesser good fortunes of all planets. Now, we're talking about pagan Gentile astrologers. And note this, while this conjunction was occurring, the sun, representing the Supreme Father, the moon, also considered a mother, and Mercury, the messenger of the gods, they were all located in the single constellation of Leo, the lion. Christians called Jesus, quote, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David. This is in Revelation 5, verse 5. These primary bodies clustering in Leo, while Jupiter and Venus were now in close union, may reflect biblical significance. Note what Alcott remarked about the sign of Leo in his book, Star Lore of All Ages. Quote, the lion was the symbol of the tribe of Judah, and the constellation appears in the Hebrew zodiac. Moving on. The association of Leo with Judah arose from the fact that Leo was Judah's natal sign. In the Bible, there were frequent allusions to this connection between Leo and the tribe of Judah. Thus we read, Judah is the lion's whelp, and again, the lion of the tribe of Judah. Unquote. End quote. The interesting astral relationships which occurred in the pre-dawn of August 12th, 3 BC, could well have signified to astrologers, now we don't know what they were thinking, but all the indications are there. Could have well signified to astrologers that some important royal event was soon to happen in the Jewish nation. Now, there were a whole host of grand astronomical displays, as we've noted. But another interesting celestial occasion occurs in the heavens 20 days later from August 12th. Mercury, the messenger of the gods, left its position with the sun, the Supreme Father, and positioned itself in close conjunction with the planet Venus. This took place when the sun had just entered the constellation of Virgo, the Virgin. Mercury, the messenger, and Venus were then both in the constellation of Leo, the lion, and Jupiter, the king planet, was just then entering Leo. All of these astral signs echo clear biblical themes. God was called the, quote, the Son of Righteousness, end quote, in Malachi 4, verse 2. And in the New Testament, he is called God the Father. Christians believed that God's Son was to be born of a virgin, and indeed he was, to be a descendant of Judah, which he was, Leo the Lion. The sign was Leo the Lion, and destined to be introduced by a messenger, who, of course, was John the Baptist. Now, in Mark chapter 1 and verse 2, it says, quote, "And it is written in the prophets, Behold, I send my messenger before your face, which shall prepare your way before you." Now, were these celestial relationships a signal to the Magi that some royal birth was soon to occur among the Jews? This was not all that happened in the year 3 to 2 BC. Following these initial planetary conjunctions, Jupiter then moved on, as we've shown in chapter 1, to unite with the star Regulus on September 14th, 3 BC. Indeed, it joined with Regulus, the king star, the king planet, joining with the king star on three different occasions in that astronomical year. Now, signaling the birth of a king, these three unions could have been of great consequence to astrologers. Regulus was known as the king. The Romans referred to it as Rex, which means king in Latin. In Arabia, the star was known as the kingly one. The Greeks called Regulus the king star. Of all the stars in the heavens, Regulus was universally associated by ancient astrologers with the attributes of greatness and power. It is located practically on the ecliptic, and this is the path in the sky which the sun takes in traversing the heavens. It was thought that this position made it of special importance to the sun. According to astrologers, the sun ruled the heavens. Thus, the major star closest to the ecliptic of the ruling sun was Regulus. This close relationship to the sun made Regulus a royal star, the one most associated with the conception or birth of kings. It was the star denoting rulership. With this in mind, we should recall the prophecy of Balaam recorded by Moses in the book of Numbers. He spoke about a star to rise in Israel that would be connected with rulership or dominion. Quote, "A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter, or a ruling rod, shall rise out of Israel." And this is in Numbers 24, verse 17. The arrangement of these verses in the prophecy shows that the star is connected with a scepter. This suggests that the star would symbolically represent dominion. This is made clear in the following verse of the prophecy. Quote, "Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion." This is Numbers 24, verse 19. This is why the scepter is associated with the star. It was was the tribe of Judah, Leo the lion, that was prophesied to possess this scepter in Israel. Quote, Judah is a lion's whelp. He couched as a lion. The scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh come. And this is portions of Genesis chapter 49, verses 9 and 10. Judah is associated with a lion, lion's whelp, couched as a lion, and the scepter, and Shiloh.
What does that part mean, until Shiloh come?
Shiloh, till Shiloh come, actually refers to God going back to Shiloh. And this will occur, in Dr. Martin's understanding, in the millennium when the Ezekiel temple is built at Shiloh, and it will be so large that it will encompass about 60 miles south, the entire temple complex, will encompass 60 miles south into Jerusalem. So it will be a huge, the Ezekiel temple, which will be the millennial structure, will be a huge, huge structure, nowhere near as big as the New Jerusalem that comes down from heaven, for sure. But that won't even begin to be constructed until some, according to Dr. Martin's rendering or understanding, about some 70 years after the start of the millennium. Because the earth has to heal first, and then Christ will start ruling. He'll be in the area, but he won't really start ruling from that piece of land, from Shiloh, until the temple has begun its construction. So, Judah, the scepter shall not depart from Judah till Shiloh come. Since the Bible talks of the star, a scepter, and Judah, the lion, Leo, is the only star in the heavens that fits this combination of factor mentioned by Balaam, that is the star Regulus. That's the only star that fits. The use of biblical astronomy in prophetic themes. In biblical symbolism, Regulus is the star of the Messiah. It is located directly between the feet of the lion in the constellation of Leo. Moses even prophesied that Judah, the lion, would have a, quote, lawgiver from between his feet till Shiloh come. Once again, Genesis 49, verse 10. Alfred Jeremias, back in 1911, showed that this prophecy referred to the star Regulus. This is in Jeremias, the Old Testament, in light of the ancient Near East. This was also shown by Roger Sinott in his 1968 article in Sky and Telescope. Now, there can hardly be a doubt that this determination of Sinott and Jeremias is correct. It has always been known that the major star Regulus, which was situated practically on the ecliptic of the sun, was between the lion's paws. Indeed, Regulus was, and still is, positioned precisely where the prophecy placed it, between the feet of Leo the lion. Now, there's a diagram online and in the printed book that shows this clearly, and any star map will show you this. Leo was the constellation assigned to Judah. When it is realized that Regulus was recognized by the early Jews as the star of the Messiah, we can then symbolically apply some significant astronomical occurrences in the year 3 to 2 BC that involve Regulus, the king star, and the planet Jupiter, the king planet. Now let's look at the interesting and heavenly relationship that developed between Jupiter, the king planet, and Regulus, the king star, in the year 3 to 2 BC. There were three conjunctions in which both heavenly bodies seemed to be centering on each other. And this covered an 8-month period. It was as if Jupiter were homing in on Regulus, using it as an access and direct directing earthly attention to it. This could have easily signified to astrologers that some royal event was to occur. And while the Magi must have considered all three of these as having real importance, note especially the first of the three conjunctions of Jupiter and Regulus on September 14, 3 BC. Now, here was Jupiter. Remember, Jesus was born on September 11th, and we're talking about September 14th, 3 days later, when viewed by the Magi, back wherever they began. Now, here was Jupiter, the king planet, which had just united with Venus, the mother, on August 12th, 3 BC, now joining itself with the king star Regulus, the star of the Jewish Messiah, in the zodiacal sign of Leo, the constellation of Judah, while the sun, the supreme father or ruler, was then located in Virgo, the virgin. All of these features are reminiscent of biblical themes associated with the birth and personage of the Jewish Messiah. Recall that the Messiah was prophesied to be born of a virgin and to be the king of Judah. King Herod must have wondered about this initial display of Jupiter with Regulus, although it didn't mean anything to him, and his own counselors didn't tell him until sometime later the Magi told him the significance of this. Now, then note what happened after the September 14th, 3 BC event. The second conjunction of Jupiter and Regulus occurred on February 17th, 2 BC. Amazingly, the moon came to be positioned at that exact time between Jupiter and Regulus. At about 5 a.m., looking at the western horizon, an observer would have seen the moon directly between Jupiter and Regulus, the three brightest objects in the sky, almost, other than Venus at the dawn. The moon would have been occulting, covering up the star Regulus with the lower fifth of the moon's diameter. Then, on May 8th and 9th, in 2 BC, 82 days later, the same conjunction occurred again. This time, however, the moon occulted or covered Regulus by the top one-fifth of its diameter. The last conjunction would not have been seen in Palestine, since the moon was already below the horizon in the west. Yet astrologers such as the Magi would have known exactly what was happening. These three conjunctions of Jupiter with Regulus would have shown Jupiter making a type of crowning effect over the star Regulus. It was like the king planet was placing a crown, like a circular diadem, over the king star, the star of the Messiah. And importantly, all this occurred within the constellation of Leo the Lion, the zodiacal sign of Judah. Now, there's more spectacular signs. These were not all the signs of that occurred in 3 to 2 BC. After the planet's separate conjunctions with Regulus, Jupiter then continued its westward journey, as observers would have viewed it on Earth, or from Earth. On June 17, 2 BC, it had its spectacularly rare union with Venus, which we mentioned in the first chapter of this book. The two planets were then a mere 0.01 degree from one another, and they would have appeared to people on Earth like a single double star, which only the sharpest eyes would have been able to separate. So let's see what this would have meant to the Magi. Venus, now in its double role as mother, because the planet was now an evening star, had just extended itself as far east as possible to encounter Jupiter, the king planet, which was moving west in a direct path to meet her. Now, what occurred was a splendid planetary conjunction visible west of Babylon if you're in Babylon and face west, or anywhere near Babylon. Besides that, this beautiful conjunction again happened while the planets were in the constellation of Leo in Judah, meaning Judah, at the exact time of the full moon. So close were the two planets that they would have appeared very much like one gigantic star in a marriage union with each other. Furthermore, the Magi, who would have been in Mesopotamia, would have witnessed this planetary union appearing on the western horizon precisely in the direction of Judea. This celestial occurrence prompted the science writer Isaac Asimov to ask the question, quote, is the fact that the unusual star was seen in the direction of Judea enough to make them think of a Messiah? And this is in Isaac Asimov's book, The Planet That Wasn't. This heavenly scene could well have produced an interest in the Magi to look toward Jerusalem, and not to the celebrations in Rome for the arrival of the Messianic King of the world. It could have been interpreted that these two planets, which introduced the prophesied king in their symbolic way when they were both morning stars some 10 months before, were now completing their introduction with an impressively rare evening star union. What a beautiful display this last rendezvous would have made in the early evening sky west of Babylon. But about an hour later, the planets would have appeared even closer to observers in Palestine. There had been nothing like this brilliant conjunction for centuries, nor would there be again for many generations. While the earlier conjunction of Jupiter and Venus on August 12th, 3 BC, occurred in the closing degrees of the constellation of Cancer, this reunion some 10 months later took place just beyond the zero line for astrological reckoning in the constellation of Leo the Lion. And this would be according to the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics. It could well have symbolized to the Magi the closing of one era and the beginning of another significant era. Now, we're going to consider the impressive signs 3 to 2 BC together. The astronomical displays were not over for that significant year. On August 27th, 2 BC, 72 days after the spectacular Jupiter-Venus reunion, there occurred the extremely close conjunction of Jupiter with Mars, the planet of war. While Venus and Mercury homed in on them both, in an unusual massing of four planets, Jupiter was located at 142.6 degrees, Mars at 142.64 degrees, Venus at 141.67 degrees, and Mercury at 143.71 degrees. Such closeness in the pre-dawn skies would have given astrologers much to talk about, especially when the other events of the year were astronomical events of the year were connected with it. Now look at the massing of the planets. All of the primary planets, except Saturn, were now clustering near one another in the constellation of Leo, while the moon was just entering Leo. The sun, however, at that very time, was entering the sign of Virgo, the Virgin. These indications, once again, show remarkable prophetic themes mentioned in the Bible that people were looking for at that time. Now, what might this massing of the planets have meant to the Magi? Since Jupiter, Mars, Venus, and Mercury had just become new morning stars, it could well have signified that war, because Mars was involved, war would break out on the Earth just before the dawning of the new day, which the planetary signs were supposedly introducing. And this is would be according to Jeremiah chapter 30, verses 6 to 7. The world was then then looking for a new golden age to emerge. Excuse me. The messianic teachings of the Old Testament showed that the new age would be introduced by a war to end all wars. Perhaps astrologers interpreted that it was the king of the tribe of Judah who would bring in this new age. The poet Virgil, a few years before these events took place in the sky, in his fourth eclogue, had given a prophetic teaching that such a golden age was destined to come to earth. One thing is certain. The year 3 to 2 BC was replete with visible astronomical events.
David?
Yeah.
Boy, my voice is awful. Isn't this sort of, in a manner of speaking, what people are looking for again today?
Yeah, and remember in Luke 21, Christ says specifically, there will be signs in the sky.
Yes.
Whether it's Shoemaker Levy of, you know, planetary killers, comet, which broke into some 20-plus parts and hit the planet Jupiter, you know, such any one of those parts would have, you know, as we're told, been large enough to be a mass extinction event on Earth, meaning you, me, and everyone in the audience. Any one of those 20-plus chunks of ice.
And a war to end all wars would
Usher
in a new age.
And by the way, those comet pieces broke up and started to hit Jupiter on the 9th of Ab. The same day that Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD and when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem in 586 or whenever that took place. Date, exact year is uncertain. So that perked up, and the whole world saw that because we saw it happening live with a 30-minute delay because of the speed of light. Jupiter was that far away. But these things will happen again, and as we've covered in terms of asteroid destruction, those events are prophesied unless the world receives the message that God wants to receive it, then he can mitigate somewhat the destruction that might be coming. Now, it would also, like you say, entail events perhaps not just of a destructive nature, but also, you know, that things are going to start popping again. Dr. Martin did not ever look into that in terms of the future to us, but the time frame, if it is within 100 years and not 400, 500, or another 1,000 years, if it would certainly occur probably within, 100 years from 1998. That was Dr. Martin's latest and best a guesstimate, you might say, and that's without setting dates. But he never did go out and see what type of signs in the sky there would be. You would expect that the second coming would be as significant to mankind and scriptural information as would be the first coming.
Right.
So, your point is well taken. There will be signs in the skies, and they won't all be bad. A lot of them would be indicators if, once again, those who study and show themselves approved and those who have eyes to see and ears to hear, we should be able to do that and understand, to get a good idea as to what and when. Then when you start mixing and taking the symbols outside of Scripture at, as important, they're just symbols. Symbols are not reality, okay? And people get mixed up, just like the icons of, some saint in a church.
Yes.
It means nothing, and it shouldn't even be there. They shouldn't even be there because people literally pray in front of those objects, whether it's Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Roman Catholic, or whatever.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, that idolatry assisted Islam in their conquest of the Middle East because it made so much sense. You know, the Bible says we're not supposed to have idols. There's idols all over the place. So it created an atmosphere of receptivity to Islam, as well as natural disasters and famines and pestilence, which decreased the population, which made the Arab surge out of Arabia to be, made it even feasible and possible. But, you know, praying to idols or a little fat man at Christmas, you know, a little fat elf, which, you know, some people actually consider a demonic personality, this stuff is just stupid. It just makes no sense. And people say, well, we need this to focus our attention and our prayers, and we just use it as a focusing device. And, you know, you get into this mind game of what, you know, the mind can conceive, and it helps me direct my prayers and all that garbage. Look, God is right there. He's right here, if you will. You don't need an intermediary. There's one God the Father and one Lord Jesus Christ, and there's one mediator between God and man. Nobody else, nothing else, not a spirit, an angel, a man, or anything else, and not, certainly not the stars. So, you know, all this stuff, your point is well taken. These symbols and signs in the skies individually mean nothing except to the point where they point to Christ, and then once you see the symbol and once you're pointed in the right direction, then you forget about the symbol and you direct your attention to Christ and the scriptures, the Word of God. Right. You forget should forget about the other garbage comparatively. You know, the signs in the skies are there for us to pay attention to, but you don't focus on those or make them to be gods. You know.
That's right.
So, yeah, the signs will not all be bad approaching the second coming. And no one has done that research standing on Dr. Martin's shoulders yet to do this. So there's a task for those who have a facility for looking at astronomical events. And it's easier than ever these days with the astronomy programs, which look to the past and the future from today, to see if you have a correct biblical understanding of how these events are symbolically related, to see, well, this might be interesting, this might be worth looking at, and then, you know, we'd be surprised what might be in the scriptures, in the Psalms, in the book of Job, all sorts of, in the prophecies of Jeremiah and Isaiah, all of which have astronomical elements and references to them that we do not fully understand. And much of prophecy will not be understood until you get very close to the events themselves. So, you know, it'll be an exciting time. And hopefully things recognizable will begin to occur within our lifetime in a time frame that we can start checking off events, not in a date sequence, but in an event sequence. Okay, this has to happen first, second, third, so you can check off the first one because this happened. Okay, Israel is back in the land, and we'll check that off. And, you know, let's see, what would be one? Lebanon is splitting into two parts. The Palestinian people have their homeland, and things are starting to settle out, and Babylon is beginning to be rebuilt. And Assyria is starting to form up, which indeed they are, as the you know, the Kurds gain more and more power and strength and independence in the north of Iraq, but also in western Turkey and parts of Iran. Whether they will break away, who knows? Whether Turkey will survive as an entity, perhaps, I don't know. Perhaps the churches of Revelation, each of which... Revelation chapters 2 and chapter 3, each of which refer to a Christian congregation at the second coming of Christ. Is that a prophecy? that will also be fulfilled at the end time? I don't know. If that's the case, some of those cities have to be rebuilt, or cities nearby have to be renamed, or there has to be a Christian congregation in each of those seven cities. I don't know. It's intriguing to look at and to consider. But each of those prophecies in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, dealing with the ecclesias of the seven ecclesias in Revelation, each of them talk about Christ coming soon. Now, you know, I don't know how you read that, but I read it in a very way that might indeed be the case. But it takes time to rebuild those small towns. And, you know, who knows? We'll see. So back to the text. But Dr. Martin says that one thing is certain. The year 3 to 2 BC was replete with visible astronomical events. And since Genesis chapter 1, verse 14 says that the heavenly bodies were accounted for signs, perhaps these unusual relationships were interpreted by the Magi as indicating the birth of the Jewish Messiah into the world. And as an aside again, certainly the return of the Jewish Messiah would also be a very significant event to mankind and to God and to Christ, so that there should be also, you would expect, events linked to that, not to set dates. Because remember, when we look at the birth of Christ, there were events and conjunctions before, and then he was born on September 11th, 3 BC, and there were other events which solidified the significance of the event of September 11th, okay, the birth of Christ. And the Magi did not know what we know from John, from Revelation chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, I think it's verse 1, regarding the precise time stamp after the fact, after Christ was born, of the exact time. So the Magi had to look at all the events, and that impressed them so much that they felt compelled to travel to Judea and find and locate this king. Okay, so now the outcome of these astronomical signs. Let's look at some. I need to switch phones here, so hold on just a second. Okay, hello?
Yes.
Yep, I guess we got to pause because I can't get a signal.
Okay, here we go. We apologize for that interruption, but switching phones back and forth. Oh, my. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. Yeah, we're switching handsets because the battery of the headset doesn't continue very long. But continuing on with chapter 4, the real Star of Bethlehem, we've come to a section entitled The Outcome of These Astronomical Signs. Continuing on with Dr. Martin's text. So let us now look at some interesting biblical teaching that could suggest what I am saying is true. It has long been recognized that the Magi arrived in Jerusalem some time after Jesus was born, and this is in Matthew chapter 2, verse 2. Jesus had already been circumcised and presented in the temple 40 days after his birth. This was in Luke 2, verses 21 to 24. When the Magi arrived, the parents of Jesus were then living in a house and not a stable. This is specified in Matthew 2, verse 11. Jesus was also being called a paidon, which is ordinarily a child or a toddler, not a brephos in Greek, an infant. One cannot press the meaning of these two terms too far, but there were ordinary differences between them that most contexts would acknowledge as showing a distinction between a brephos and a paideon, an infant and a toddler. After the Magi presented their gifts, they returned home by a different route because they were told to do so by an angel. And in response to this subterfuge, King Herod slew the male children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years of age and younger. And this is in Matthew 21, verse 16. Since it is often difficult for astrologers to interpret whether heavenly signs were indicating events associated with conception or birth, King Herod no doubt maneuvered his strategy against the newborn child by taking both possibilities into account. In other words, the earliest time and the latest time. He killed the children up to 2 years of age so he could include those children, both conceived and born within that 2 year period of time. Whatever the case, all of these indications show that the Magi must have arrived in Bethlehem to present their gifts several months after the birth of Jesus. This leads us to the final suggestion that could help us identify the, quote, star of Bethlehem, end quote, that the stellar body that played the most prominent role in the extraordinary year of 3 to 2 BC, and the planet, which figured in almost every celestial relationship, that was the planet Jupiter. It could well be that Jupiter was, quote, his star, end quote, that the Magi followed to Jerusalem and finally to Bethlehem. So now we're going to consider the proper star of Bethlehem. So let us observe some factors that could go a long way to show this. Recall that the account in the New Testament said that the Magi astrologers saw the star rising above the eastern horizon. And in August 12th, 3 BC, Jupiter rose as a morning star, which soon came into conjunction with the planet Venus. That started Jupiter off on a journey in which six conjunctions with other planets and the star Regulus took place. The final planetary union was the massing of the planets, which occurred with Mars, Venus, and Mercury on August 27, 2 BC. But there was one more astronomical display that involved the planet Jupiter at the end of 2 BC. The planet soon left its massing with the other three planets and continued in its apparent motion westward each morning as viewed by the Magi at their regular pre-dawn observations. If the Magi began their own journey toward Jerusalem near this time, this apparent westward motion of Jupiter each day would have indicated to the Magi to proceed in the same westward direction toward Jerusalem. They could have been, quote, following, end quote, Jupiter in the example it was setting. The Bible says the star, quote, went ahead of them, and this is in Matthew 2, verse 9. The text could well mean that the Magi let Jupiter lead them in this symbolic fashion. But Dr. Martin says he will give more on this in a moment. Then notice what took place. Upon reaching Jerusalem, the Magi were told to look toward Bethlehem for the newborn king. This happened when the New Testament says the star came to a definite halt in the heavens. And this is according to Kittel's Theological Dictionary regarding the star. It stopped its motion of leading the Magi and, quote, stood over where the child was, end quote, according to Matthew 2:9. Now remember, this is some considerable amount of time, more than a year after Jesus was born, once again in Bethlehem. Now, in a word, the celestial body became stationary. Now, let's note this one point carefully. The text does not say that the star stood over the house. Some have imagined that this is what Matthew meant, and songs have got that all muddied up. This assumption is totally unwarranted. Such presumption is reading into the text, called eisegesis, reading into the text that which is not there. What we want to do is have exegesis, which is reading out from the text what is really there. What the New Testament states is that the star became stationary. But whoever heard of a star becoming stationary in the heavens? Well, the star actually did stand still. It is this description of the star standing still that has caused many interpreters to characterize the entire episode of Matthew as either fictitious or a miraculous event. Most people find it difficult to imagine a normal heavenly body having the capability of stopping its movement over a small village in Palestine. Well, at first thought, a person might agree that such a thing appears to be impossible, but maybe the account is not as ridiculous as it may seem. In truth, there's not the slightest difficulty for such a thing to happen. The truth is, Matthew was simply describing a celestial phenomenon in popular language that all astronomers and persons acquainted with the basic planetary motions would have been fully aware. Planets do come to a stop at prescribed times in their heavenly motions. This happens at the time for a planet's retrogression and progression. It may be that Matthew was simply showing that Jupiter had become stationary in its motions through the sky, through the fixed stars at the time it reached its zenith over Bethlehem. The theologian F. Steinmetzer, back in 1912, wrote an article stating his belief that Matthew was referring to one of these normal stationary motion positions of the planets. And this is in Steinmetzer's article, The Star of the Wise Men, in the Irish Theological Quarterly. Now, indeed, Steinmetzer suggested that the planet that suited Matthew's account best was the planet Jupiter. And indeed, this is true. Jupiter does stop in the heavens. Now, how is that possible? Well, there is a diagram that shows that Jupiter has a larger, of course, much greater and larger planetary orbit than does the Earth. And that when the Earth is approaching Jupiter, if you look at the think of the solar system as a been viewed from the top. Okay, you have Jupiter out ahead, and then the Earth moves quicker in its inner orbit, and then passes Jupiter. Jupiter's apparent position in the sky, and then Jupiter would appear to go backwards when viewed from Earth. If you can kind of visualize that, Jupiter becomes stationary at its times for retrogression and progression. When we look at Jupiter, we see the planet normally moving eastward each evening through the fixed stars. And this is different than the rotation of the Earth position. You would take the viewing each time at the same time each night, and you would notice that each time at night when you would take a reading of the position of Jupiter, it would progress eastward, okay, each evening through the fixed stars. This apparent movement is called proper motion. The Earth, however, is moving around in its orbit around the Sun faster than that of Jupiter. When the Earth reaches a particular point, an observer would see Jupiter. Let's call it point A. An observer would see Jupiter nearly along the same line as the Earth's own orbital movement. When the Earth is traveling more or less in a direct line toward Jupiter, relatively speaking, the planet will continue to show proper motion. But when the Earth reaches what we could call position B, it is no longer heading toward Jupiter. Indeed, the faster velocity of the Earth makes it makes its turn to B and beyond, to C and D, causes the apparent motion of Jupiter to slow down. This continues until the Earth reaches what we can call position C. At that point, the speed of the Earth in relation to Jupiter is the same as Jupiter's. That is when Jupiter appears to become stationary in the background of the fixed stars. As the Earth progresses from C to D, from position C to position D, it has a greater relative speed than Jupiter, and this causes Jupiter to retrogress toward the west. The planet reverses its motion and travels westward through the stars. At position D, however, the speed of the Earth and Jupiter are again matched relative to each other, and Jupiter stops its reverse motion. When D is passed, Jupiter returns to proper motion. This is what happened when Jupiter came in contact with the star Regulus on three different occasions in the late part of 3 BC and the early part of 2 BC. And the diagram that's on the website shows how this occurs. And also, by the way, if you want a beautiful visual representation of what happens, is the link to the MSNBC Griffith Planetarium a website, which explains the retrograde motion. We have it linked on the ASK website. It's also linked on the Byte Show website, right, Georgianne?
Yeah.
So let's look at what happened at the end of 2 BC. Jupiter arrived at its ordinary time for retrogression, and it became stationary among the stars. But this time, something unusual happened. In 2 BC, as viewed from Jerusalem, Jupiter came to its normal stationary position directly over Bethlehem on December 25th, 2 BC. That's right. Just before the dawn, the regular time the Magi would have begun their normal observations of the heavens, Jupiter came to a stopped position on December 25th, directly over Bethlehem, as witnessed from Jerusalem. This would have been a year and a quarter after Jesus was born. So he would have been about a year and 3 months if he was born on September 11th, as Dr. Martin indicates, and I believe that to be the case. Not only that, the planet assumed its stationary position while in the middle of the constellation of Virgo the Virgin. What a remarkable, lucky circumstance that was.
Yeah.
Now, Jupiter stopped within the sign of Virgo the Virgin has a significance, of course. We are told in the New Testament that Jesus was born of a virgin. And precisely on December 25th, 2 BC, Jupiter stopped in the abdomen region of Virgo the Virgin, in the middle of the constellation. This position was right where a woman carries a child in pregnancy. On that day, the king planet stopped its lateral motion through the stars and remained stationary for about 6 days. During those days, it did not move longitudinally more than 1/40th of the moon's diameter from its December 25th position. To an observer on Earth, it appeared completely stationary in the midst of Virgo. This would have appeared significant to astrologers. They looked on the winter solstice period as the beginning of the new sun. This period signified to many Gentile astrologers as the time for showing the birth of the sun. It was celebrated in most areas of the world as the nativity of the ruler of the heavens. And the king planet, Jupiter, was now stationary in the central region of Virgo the Virgin. Now, be this as it may, how was it possible for Jupiter to be stationary over the village of Bethlehem at that time? Well, there's not the slightest problem for it to do so. The Bible says that the Magi saw the star come to a stop while they were in Jerusalem. And on December 25th, 2 BC, at the ordinary time for the Magi's pre-dawn observations, Jupiter would have been seen in the meridian position directly over Bethlehem at an elevation of some 68 degrees. If you stick your hand out at the horizontal and then put it straight up, that's 90 degrees. So 68 degrees would have been about two-thirds of the way up, a little more than two-thirds of the way up, above the southern horizon. This precise position would show the planet shining directly down on Bethlehem while it was stationary among the stars. What a remarkable coincidence this was. And though this period has nothing to do with the actual birth of Jesus, as we'll show later in the book, it may have been the time when the Magi presented their gifts to Jesus. This could be a reason why people in later Christian church said that December 25th was a day associated with the Magi presenting their costly and royal gifts to the newborn Jesus, which of course has nothing to do with us celebrating it on the 25th, because he wasn't born then. Anyway, the star led the Magi to Jesus. While all this is true, there is nevertheless a problem to be reckoned with. Matthew said that the star, quote, went before them. And since the Magi were then in Jerusalem when this was stated, and because Jerusalem was located 5 miles south of where Herod's palace would have been, how could Jupiter, or any planet or star, appear to move from north to south, leading the Magi to Bethlehem? Does this mean that the whole story must be reckoned as fictitious or miraculous after all? Well, not really. A careful reading of Matthew may make the matter clear. The Weymouth translates this passage as, quote, the star they had seen when it rose led them on until it reached and stood over the place where the babe was. This verse is interesting and revealing, has interesting and revealing information in it when read closely. It helps to show that the Magi had been following the star from the time it rose, which they saw at their homes in the east. They continued to follow it until they reached Jerusalem. The Church Father Chrysostom also understood Matthew in the same way. And this is in Chrysostom's Matthew homily, chapter 6, verse 3, quote, for on their way as far as Palestine, it, meaning the star, appeared leading them. But after they set foot in Jerusalem, it hid itself. Then again, when they left Herod, having told him on what account they came and were on the point of departing, it showed itself again. Well, there are other indications in the text of Matthew which shows that this may be the intended meaning. One should look very carefully at the text because it has some interesting points associated with it. In regard to this, the authors of the Expositor's Greek New Testament ask the following question. And this is 1 verse 73. Is the meaning that they had seen the star only at its rising, finding their way to Jerusalem without its guidance, and that again it appeared leading them to Bethlehem? Against this is verse 7, which implies continuous visibility. It was their celestial guide appearing again after they left Herod. It kept going before them. This is in the imperfect sense. All the way till arriving at Bethlehem, it took up its position right over the spot where the child was. Now, the use of the imperfect tense in verse 9 of Matthew 2 shows that the star was constantly leading them, while verse 7 suggests it was a continually appearing star. The star seems to be temporarily have been obscured while the Magi visited Herod at his palace. Clouds may have then covered it, or it may have been below the horizon when at the time they visited the king. Upon leaving the palace, however, they once again saw their celestial guide. It had led them westward to Jerusalem, but now it came to be in a meridian position over Bethlehem. It was stationary among the stars and shining down directly over Bethlehem as viewed from Jerusalem on December 25th. It was now pointing out the exact geographical location of the newborn king. Interestingly, while Jupiter was in its standing still position over Bethlehem, the sun was also standing still. And most everyone knows that December 25th is in the usual period of what's called the winter solstice. The word solstice itself means the sun stands still. These stationary coincidences of Jupiter and the sun are quite related and would surely have appeared significant to astrologers at the time. The historian Cumont has the following evaluation in his book Astrology and Religion Among the Greeks and Romans, page 89. Quote, general observance required that on the 25th of December, the birth of the new sun should be celebrated, when after the winter solstice, the days began to lengthen, and the invincible star triumphed again over darkness. End quote. Now recall that even Luke said at the beginning of his gospel that, quote, the day spring from on high has visited us to give light to them that sit in darkness, end quote. Luke 1, verses 78 to 79. The Magi, being astrologers, would no doubt have wanted to give gifts to the, quote, newborn sun. And in the book of Malachi, the God of Israel is called the Son of Righteousness, in Malachi 4, verse 2. They would have supposed that the child in their midst was the one destined to usher in the new golden age that most were then expecting. Professor Mircea Eliade, whom many consider to be the foremost authority on past and present religious customs of peoples, has shown that the ancients looked on the dawning of each new year, the solstice period, as symbolic of the inauguration of the new age. And this is in Eliade's Cosmos and History, pages 51 to 62. The Magi would have been aware of these well-known beliefs, and here they were, after making their long journey with expensive gifts to give to the newborn king, now discovering from their point of view in Jerusalem that the Son, the Supreme Father, was, quote, standing still, end quote, in the heavens while Jupiter, the king planet, was also standing still. These features could fit Matthew's account perfectly. Now, what would have been the interpretation of the Magi? Well, we can't get into their heads, but being astrologers, the Magi being Gentiles, would have approached this astronomical relationship from their own religious point of view, not necessarily from the Jewish point of view. Almost all non-Jewish societies placed great emphasis on the occasion of the rebirth of the sun god at each winter solstice, and they had many religious celebrations to accompany it. Jews, however, would not have viewed this season of the year in that fashion. Most Jews at the time abhorred these Gentile religious festivals at the winter solstice or at any other seasons of the year. They could point to the prophet Jeremiah, who commanded that the Jews never adhere to Gentile religious customs involving the various solstice or equinox seasons of the year. This is in Jeremiah 10, verses 1 to 4. The Jews considered these to be Gentile practices. Now, the Jews in Jerusalem would have looked on these astronomical signs in 3 to 2 BC very differently. In fact, December 25th in 2 BC was not a time of solstice celebrations to the Jews. Remarkably, however, it was a period for great festivity throughout the whole of the Jewish nation. It happened to be the precise time for their feast of Hanukkah, sometimes spelled Chanukah. This was a feast of the Jews held near the beginning of the winter, and it is mentioned in the New Testament as the Feast of Dedication in John 10, verse 22. The start of the eight-day celebration can sometimes occur as early as November 28th or as late as December 27th in our solar calendar. The Jewish months can vary at times as much as a month out of phase with the solar calendar that we use today. But in the year 2 BC, it is evident that Hanukkah began on December 23rd. The Magi would have given their gifts to the newborn babe on the third day of the Jewish festival. This would have been an interesting and symbolic time to present their gifts to the one they considered to be the Messianic King that the Jewish nation was then expecting to appear. This was because Hanukkah was a time for gift-giving. Now we're going to look at the Magi and the Jewish Feast of Hanukkah. The Feast of Hanukkah was not ordained in the New Testament, but all Jews held it in high esteem. It took on a secular and religious importance that was second only to the Passover season, according to J.S. Rockland, the Hanukkah book. It commemorated the time in 164 B.C., when the temple had been cleansed of Gentile idols placed there by Antiochus Epiphanes. The temple had been cleansed of Gentile idols placed there by Antiochus. It had been desolate in its holiness for 3 years. But the Jewish month of Kislev, on the 25th day of the month, the Maccabees once again reestablished the temple services. That particular day and the 7 days that followed were reckoned as days of celebration for the Jewish triumph over what they considered to be paganism and heathen idolatry. The Jewish symbolism associated with these days is the very antithesis of what the Gentile nations were symbolizing at their winter solstice celebrations. This probably included the symbolic beliefs that the Magi themselves adhered to in their role as Magian priests. Hanukkah was considered a festival of dedication, or rather rededication, of the temple and Jewish people, and a rededication of Jewish people to the God of Abraham and Moses. For this reason, it became known as a festival of renewal. From the middle of the 2nd century BC onward, the Jews regularly assembled each year at that time in the temple or their synagogues. They carried branches of trees and palms in their hands, singing psalms to God for the great salvation that they considered they had been given. Quoting Rockland, they looked on Hanukkah as a second Feast of Tabernacles, which symbolized the redemption of the Jews and the entire world to God. No fast or mourning because of any calamity or bereavement was permitted to be initiated during those 8 days. It was a time of festivity and celebration. The temple, synagogues, and all houses in the nation were lighted both within and without by many lamps and torches during the whole period. Josephus, the Jewish historian Josephus, for this reason, called the festival of Hanukkah the Feast of Lamps. The whole Jewish nation was in celebration. The Magi would then have witnessed the entire Jewish nation in a holiday spirit. As though they were taking part in the celebrations, these Eastern priests would have given their gifts to the young child or toddler in Bethlehem on the third day of the celebration of the Jewish festival. This was a time when the Jewish people were in a happy mood, with the whole landscape around Jerusalem and Bethlehem being illuminated with an abundance of lights. And remember, Bethlehem was only 5 miles south. That's just a short walk for people in those days. Would have been done in, probably an hour and a half. at, you know, 2 or 3 miles an hour. Interestingly, it was this precise period when it was customary for Jewish people to give gifts to their children. From the Jewish point of view, there would have been no better time for the Magi to present their gifts to a Jewish child than at this period of Hanukkah. This was a traditional time for gift-giving. The Jews, however, would not have been honoring the season as devoted to the renewal of the sun god. It would have been just the opposite for them. To the Jews, it was their time to celebrate their triumph over the idolatry of the Gentiles and the renewal of their lives to the God of Abraham and Moses. It's interesting that a permanent removal of idolatry from the world was prophesied in the Old Testament to take place at the advent of the Messiah. The dedication of the Messiah to the world at the Feast of Dedication may well have seemed an important time for such a messianic christening to the Jews of the first century. There can be no doubt that the symbolic emphasis of the Jews regarding these astronomical and calendar matters in 3 to 2 BC would have been far different from those of the Magi, who were Gentile priests. And though this is true, it must be understood that the Jews would have been impressed, as were the Gentiles, at what was happening in the heavens at that particular astronomical year. They were well aware of the positive statement in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, about the legitimacy of heavenly signs. We now know by recent literary discoveries that the Jews in the first century were very concerned with interpretations involving the motions of the celestial bodies. It is certain that many Jews would have been looking for heavenly signs that would have introduced the Messiah that they were then expecting to appear on earth. The Magi gave their gifts at Hanukkah time. So what we find in this unique calendar circumstance is that the Jews were seeing Jesus as the Messiah by having the Magi give their gifts in the midst of their celebration of Hanukkah, while the heathen peoples in the world were seeing the Magi represent them at the time of their winter solstice celebrations. It's interesting that these festival occasions occurred in combination to one another in that year. Jewish and pagan celebrations combined for that year. Of course, the astrological interpretations made in this book may or may not be in conformity with those of the Magi. Only the Magi themselves could best answer what prompted them to go to Jerusalem. The Jews observing the Magi giving gifts to the child at Bethlehem may or may not have been interpreted, may have or may not have interpreted any symbolic associations in a messianic sense by the Magi's actions, even though the event happened in the midst of Hanukkah. But let's face it, none of us were there at the time to justify dogmatism on these matters. Astrological interpretation is a very subjective art, and even astrologers today are not sure how the ancients viewed all the astronomical signs. Regardless of these uncertainties, the celestial phenomena of the year 3 to 2 BC did in fact take place. So ends chapter 4, The Real Star of Bethlehem.
Well, it is really fascinating material, that's for sure.
Thank you, Georgianne, for the opportunity.
Well, thank you for taking the time to present this material. And everybody go to askelm.com. That's askelm.com. And you can email David at this address, david@askelm.com. And we will be getting to part 5 soon, I hope. Right, David?
Yeah.
Okay. And due to my my voice, I won't be saying too much tonight. Anyway, God bless everybody for listening. And you too, David, for your work. And we'll be back, God willing. Good night, everybody.